So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, on Tuesday, we head to the battlefields of medieval Spain to witness the very first ambulance.
On Wednesday, it's the anniversary of the day Coca-Cola's creator hit on his winning formula. He dropped the wine, but kept the cocaine.
On Thursday, the thief who stuffed the crown jewels down his trousers.
And on Friday, when free-spirited Danish parenting put 90s New York in a tears.
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the Retrospectors. 10 minutes every weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Hello, Man fans. Ollie Mann here with the monthly magazine show for your ears. And we have a lot coming up for you this episode. Here's just a taster.
I remember talking to my wife shortly after it all began. And I turned to her at one point and said, you know what? If people knew how easy it is to destroy someone online, they would be frightened.
When your name is smeared online, how can you fix it? I meet the man battling to save his reputation. Plus,
one goes round the base of your dong and the other one goes at the top, and every 5 seconds they compress.
Erectile dysfunction? Alex Fox rises to the occasion, and we get nosy about experiential fragrance. It's all to come in this edition of The Modern Man. But first, your letters, and in response to impending father Ollie Pitt's concerns about the smell of reusable nappies, Claire has been in touch. She says, Ollie, I would like to bust this myth. I have used all sorts of cloth nappies. I think you mean your children have, Claire. And my favourites have lanolised wool covers. When washed correctly, twice, with hot water and biodetergent, they do not smell! Thanks for that, Claire. I will gently forward your email on to Ollie when the time comes, along with a basket of muffins and balloons. Thanks as well to everybody for all your kind words about last month's edition, Military Surplus. Andy at facebook.com/Ollie Mann says, Ollie, the middle feature last month already had me in tears. Then I realised I knew one of your guests, Ken, via his husband Colin and the Phoenix Arts Club that they run in London. I knew nothing of this part of his past and all the injustice that he'd faced in his life. And Dylan says, Ollie, thank you for this amazing episode and sharing what those guys went through. It is so sad that it happened so recently. It seems like a story from decades ago. Yeah, and I think that is sort of generally the tenor of the feedback that we've received on last month, actually. It's kind of sharing my shock, I guess, that it was possible, it turns out, to go to jail in this country, to be sent to see a psychiatrist in this country just for being gay, as recently as the turn of the century. Do listen back to it if you haven't heard the episode yet. It is a cracker. And I am really, really thrilled to say that BFBS, the Forces radio station, are going to be retransmitting it as part of their Remembrance Weekend coverage. We're really delighted about that. So if you serve in the armed forces, actually, and you've discovered us through that, hello, welcome. As you'll discover, we have many listeners overseas. And I hope this is the beginning of a long relationship with your ears. Right, before we get going on today's show, my thanks as ever to all our new Beer Money contributors, Quentin Jarman, Vicky Chester, Anna Schindler, Kristen Carlson and Teodor Tonchev. We love you all, unequivocally. And also to our sponsors for this episode, beer52.com. Now, this is the time of the year when one naturally starts nesting, hibernating, gathering your winter fuel. And what could be a more reassuring, delightful thing in that context than a free box of craft beer to stuff in your cupboard? That's right, I said free. Now, I don't get it for free. I'm a subscriber. I pay Beer 52 for my monthly box. And last night we were having roast dinner. I don't know about you, I am incapable of making gravy, specifically making gravy, without having a stout beer open at the same time. The stout doesn't go in the gravy. It's not to improve the stock or something. It goes down my throat. It's just this psychosomatic thing. Smell of the meat juices propels me to a can of stout. Anyway, it was an oatmeal one. Oh, it was so good. Lingering smoky taste. But, you know, if you just prefer pale ales and lagers, you can specify that. You can tweak your monthly case to your preferences. You can cancel at any time. It is such a great British company. And if you don't believe me, why not try a free box of beer for yourself? You can get a free case of beer delivered to your door right now just for listening to this podcast. Go to beer52.com/modern to receive your first trial box of 8 beers plus a magazine plus a snack. All you cover is the cost of the postage. And if you order before Christmas 2021, folks, they will chuck in 2 extra beers for you. That is 10 beers for nothing. Beer52.com/modern. Go and get it. Beer52.com/modern. And thanks again to them. Right, coming up this month, you will learn what a Rigiscan is. You will learn why revenge websites are often based in Arizona. And you'll learn why you might be wearing ISOE Super right now. Let's go. Right, time for the Zeitgeist, your trends tested with Alex Fox.
Surprise!
We search far and wide for a replacement for Ollie Pitt whilst he's on paternity leave. I don't know how we came up with your name out the hat.
I feel like the Zeitgeist haunting Ollie P's usual section. For 1 month only, I get to ride on top, cowgirl style, and be at the beginning of the show.
You've brought me to Walthamstow. We're in the house of a lovely lady called Tasha, who is a scent designer. Why?
Because I am convinced, Ollie, that immersive scent experiences are going to be a big, big trend in coming months.
Do you think really people are going to pay specifically to have a experience based on smell?
Yes, I do. Now, using scents and smells to enhance an experience is not a new concept. One gadget, which I think you can still buy in Japan, but pretty much bombed everywhere else in the world, was called the Senti, and it was a little iPhone dongle that hung off the end of your mobile phone, and it emitted a puff of either, intriguingly, lavender, rose, or baked potato smell.
Whilst you're on the phone?
No, whenever a text message or an alert arrived at your phone, a customised scent would accompany the text from that person.
Insert Bob Monkhouse joke about the mother-in-law calling.
The world's first olfactory alarm clock, the SensorWake, was designed to wake you up to the smell of coffee or croissants instead of an annoying, buzzing, bleeping alarm.
You can just get a smart plug for a cafetiere, can't you? That's probably better.
But one of the problems that they encountered was that there's a limit to the type of scents that you can create at that sort of price point that people actually enjoy. And also, a lot of these gadgets require not just for you to invest in the initial product, but also refills for it. I find refilling the ink cartridge on my printer annoying enough. I don't want to buy loads and loads of scent cartridges. One of the reasons why I think that scent as an immersive experience is going to grow in the near future is because some people are actually experimenting with different ways of delivering that experience. So rather than actually getting you to smell a compound, which requires you to be in the room with it, there are people investigating whether they can actually stimulate the areas of your brain that pertain to scent to evoke that experience without the molecules actually needing to be in the room. Admittedly, at the moment, some of that involves putting electrodes up your schnoz, which may not appeal to everybody, but it's intriguing.
That is interesting, isn't it? So, like, whether your brain can just be triggered even perhaps by the view of something. And that's the Heston Blumenthal thing, isn't it? Like, you know, you're looking at an orange, but it tastes of a pear or whatever, and, like, your brain doesn't know how to compute that information.
If you can find a way of creating a scent in the brain without that scent needing to be present, then you have solved the problem that a lot of these gadgets face, which is the need to keep supplying parts or ingredients for them.
Okay, but when you say immersive scent experience, I mean, I've been on a tour of Brighton sewers. I'm guessing you're not talking that kind of thing.
Actually, you would be surprised. A lot of the people who are specialising in creating these experiences aren't just seeking to create something that's necessarily pleasurable. It's a lot about storytelling. It's about making you feel like you're having a very vivid experience. For example, Tasha, who we're going to speak to today, has been working with London Docklands Museum to create scents that transport you to the past so you can more viscerally experience what it might have been like to be in a particular setting or living a particular life. A lot of the people who are working on this, there's some really interesting brains. There's a woman called Olivia Jesler who runs futureofsmell.com. She is working with massive brands like Dior, Johnson & Johnson, L'Oreal. So this isn't just small museums or tiny creative artists who are experimenting. Big brands with big money are recognising that using the evocative and provocative power of smell can help to create an experience, but also can help to create ties between a person and a product that makes them much more likely to buy it.
All of which very excitingly means I'm going to get something to put up my nose. Because normally when you bring me something to sniff, it is in our Christmas episode and it is jockstraps and things that smell of fanny. But it's going to be different this time, I'm assured. Most pheromones are based on things like that, aren't they? And like deer glands and stuff. I mean, I'm improvising, Tasha, but you're the expert. What have you got for us?
We have some interesting smells here today. We've got a lovely variety for you to try, all of which have been used in a gallery or a museum or a project that I've worked on recently. So this scent that we're all wafting under our nostrils is used in an exhibition that's currently on at the Wellcome Collection in London, and it is a smell that is meant to provoke tranquility.
You know, it's so interesting how words affect what you think, isn't it? Because before you said tranquility, I was thinking it's a bit grassy and meadowy, and then as soon as you said tranquility, I was thinking, oh, is it a bit oceany? Alex, what are you getting?
To me, it smells green.
Yeah.
Mossy. I feel like I'm on a walk.
Yeah, yeah,
I know
what you mean.
That makes sense.
It smells
muddy. It smells outdoorsy. Mm-hmm. Not in an unpleasant way, not in a farmyard.
No, exactly. Yeah, no, it's not uddery, is it?
No.
Okay, so, Tasha?
I mean, you guys have very good noses. And I mean, also, I'm going to say that I got this spot on. This is the smell of the forest floor.
That is what it is.
Yeah, it's particularly based. So it's commissioned by an artist called Crystal Labasse, who does these huge photographs of ancient woodlands. And this is in particular based on the forest floor of an ancient woodland, one of the oldest ones in Japan. And it's where they coined the idea of forest bathing.
Don't you pretend suddenly, Alex, that just because you've been to Japan once, this suddenly is resonating.
Twice.
I heard
twice
what that sound was. Ah, Japan, yes. Of course. But yeah, now you mention it, forest floor is a good name for it, definitely. What is it actually that's giving me the smell? Are you going to tell me it's some chemical compound?
I mean, there's multiple things in here. It's a very complex blend, but one of the key ingredients is something called petrichor or geosamine, and it's an organic compound that is released by the earth after it rains. So it's that smell the earth releases after it rains.
Yeah, that totally is. Okay, what's next?
So this one has been turned into a candle, but it is also used in an installation that's at the Wellcome Collection, and it is part of their permanent collection. So it's actually on show at the gallery. It'll be there for at least 10 years.
So hold on, when you say on show...
So the first one I showed you, the scent there fills the entire exhibition space, so it is like you're immersed in it. This one I'm showing you now is part of a sculpture where you do have to go up quite close to be able to smell it, and it says on the label this is a scented sculpture.
Okay, I guess scented sculptures kind of counts as a thing people are going to see specifically for the smell, yeah.
Also, because we're talking about emotional experiences here and storytelling, the delivery of the scent affects the intimacy of the story, I suppose. If you walk into a room and it's all around you, then that's going to make you feel one way. If you have to get right up close to something and really bury your face in it to experience that effect, then that is going to convey a different type of feeling. So it's not just about the smell, it's about how it reaches you.
Okay, so it's in a candle pot, but I'm not going to read the label. Mm-hmm. Here goes. Ooh. It's chocolate, I think. It's not like a planty smell, and it's not a body smell.
Full disclosure, I do know what this one is.
Okay.
But I haven't inhaled this before, and I'm finding it slightly disconcerting.
Okay, well, that disturbs me while I'm putting up my nose based on you saying that. But to me, that smells like chocolate and a bit soapy.
This smell is meant to be the smell of human breast milk.
Wow! I mean, how do you research that, may I ask?
So I did go and smell lots of breast milk.
Yeah.
So I went to the Hearts Milk Bank, which is a milk bank that provides milk for premature babies and babies where their mothers can't breastfeed them for one reason or another. They gave us loads of samples, me and the perfume house called CPL Aromas, who I collaborate with to create the scents. And they got out loads of samples for us, and we had a sniff along. And then they even said, "Oh, it actually smells different when it's warm." So they went and warmed it up for us. And when they came back, I smelt the first warm sample. I had a very physical reaction to warm breast milk, because we've all probably experienced it at some point, whether from our own childhoods or from other people. You know, it's part of being human. It's the original superfood. Mm. So there is an innate familiarity there, which is quite raw and primal.
I'm now wondering whether it's reminding me in any way of lying in bed next to a lactating wife.
See, I can't work out with this one whether I am inflicting my preconceptions upon what I'm smelling, because I knew this was breast milk. So I got that sweetness and that chocolatiness that you reported. But to me, it also smells slightly sicky and a bit cloying, like it's on the turn ever so slightly.
Okay, should we try another?
Let's carry on our sniffing adventure. Ooh, this smells like men.
She says as I stick it right up my nostril. It's menthol-y, I would say.
It smells like...
And it is masculine scent, I agree. But in the sense of like classic Cartier, but also slightly BO-y as well. Like it is, yeah, it's got that rough... It's quite hard to find the vocabulary, isn't it, to describe scent?
Yeah, so we don't have a lot of words to describe scent in the English language. So we use other words. We use colours, we use textures. Mm. Saying a scent is brittle says more about it than saying, oh, it smells sweet or fragrant. You know, that's a too vague a word. It's a bit like when you read wine menus. It's more poetic. You know, this reminds me of a walk in the woods and a blustery day.
But this is basically Russell Crowe after a workout, isn't it? Is what it smells like.
You get Cartier, I get vintage cars. It smells metallic to me, like old rust or something like that.
So this is a scent that I created for London Craft Week for an installation called The Cedar in the Sea. It's actually interesting what you said about making you feel on edge, because actually one of the main components in this is cedarwood, which is meant to promote calm. It was inspired by a man called William Astor, and he was a very anxious, stressed man, and so he carved his office out of cedarwood. That smell is now gone because it was built in the 1890s. So this is the smell I introduced back in to sort of evoke some of that history, to add the layered histories back into the space. One of the compounds in there is something called Iso E Super, which is a perfume accord, which means it's a blend not found in nature. It's a synthetic accord that is found in a lot of male perfumes now. It's also got something called Cascalone in it, which again is an accord that's in a lot of male perfumes.
I can't remember whatever the Marks and Spencer one's called that you get for Christmas from your nan. It's that, isn't it? What they've had for like 50 years, that male scent from M&S. It smells a bit like that. Anyway, right, let's do one more.
Cool.
Thanks. This is fun, by the way. Have you ever done this just as like a dinner party for someone?
Never for a dinner party, but actually, funnily enough, in my job, I do quite a lot of guided smellings because we don't use our nose on its own very much.
Sorry, this is rank. Like, as you're talking, I'm just like, oh, what's that thing under my nose?
Yeah, so this is a smell that's been used for an exhibition.
Oh, God.
At the Museum of London Docklands. So it's a smell of the docks in the 1960s.
Yeah, you're telling me.
Ooh. I feel like I can smell old pubs in the 1980s and treacle, like black treacle. Yeah.
It's really rank, it's Tasha. Old. It's really, really
it
horrible.
It smells like nasty and old shit.
We're in your nice open plan house and you've progressively given us worse and worse smells. What is it?
So it is a blend of things like coffee, tea, tobacco, but also like Hessian sacks, concrete floors. It's meant to be quite an industrial smell.
It's making me feel woozy just having it near my nose, actually. You can tell these hands have never been anywhere near a dock, can't you? I'm just not at home. But also, I feel like if I was in a warehouse by a dock, then I'd accept it in a way that I can't in an indoor environment. Do you know what I mean? Like, if you were in a warehouse with a big open door and you could see the river, then you'd be like, oh, okay.
Yeah, a lot of scent is context dependent, isn't it?
Mm.
It feels more fitting when we're experiencing it within a particular environment.
Anything up my nose is nice that isn't a lateral flow test at the moment. That's what I'm used to sticking up there recently.
I've got to say, it's scary with COVID as well, being a perfumer or someone who works with scent, rather. I really couldn't lose my sense of smell. I wouldn't be able to work.
Mm.
During COVID, I ended up working a lot in the alcohol industry because we were all drinking quite a lot. So I did lots of things where I would do perfume masterclasses matching to cocktails. I would post scents to people's homes and sort of tell historical stories through scents in the post. And actually, even after COVID and during, scent was actually one of the things people really craved. We'd been amongst our own smell, our own houses, for so long. I don't know if anyone else noticed that going out of your home, people smelled different. You noticed the way that people smell, you noticed being in an alien environment. And actually then smell was one of the things we all became more sensitive to during COVID. So it was really fun to do virtual things during COVID and post smells to people's homes.
There was a bit of research done by a company called Firmenich, who did a global study and showed that 56% of people agreed that since the pandemic, they appreciate scent more. Mm. So not only is there more technology and more unusual applications, Ollie, there's more demand from people for these scent experiences.
Tasha, thank you. Absolutely fascinating. Alex, though, really, for most people listening to this, you know, it's one thing if you are going to museums based in London and you're the sort of person who would go to a sensory experience in the evening for a fun night out. But for your average person listening to this, where do you think they're going to encounter this stuff?
I think it's going to hit our homes in two particular ways. First of all, virtual reality.
Oh, God, you've been speaking to Ollie, haven't you?
Well, remember when you did that Raspberry Dream Labs sensory, sexual, sensual VR experience?
Do
that
I?
Horrible thing that I made you and Ollie do.
Erotic experience of the decade.
Well, that featured some sense, with lesser rather than greater success, I'd say. Hmm. I think that area of technology is going to get a lot more sophisticated.
Oh, Meta.
Yeah.
Are we going to have headsets with scent dispensaries in them?
Or other ways of experiencing smell. Ultimately, I think it's going to be more neurological, but that's talking way in the future. But also, I think that in an increasingly digitized world, people are looking for new ways to save their memories. We already have photographs, we already have writing, but we know that smell is one of the most immediately emotion-provoking senses that we have. Mm. I think being able to save a memory in smell so that those who come after you can experience what it was like to be you,
yeah,
in such a visceral way will be extremely popular.
It's that classic thing, isn't it? Oh, my husband died last year and I can't stop sniffing his blazers. Is that right?
Precisely. We already know how much this really speaks to people's hearts and how immediate that response is and how very powerful. I think actually harnessing that is going to appeal to a lot of people in future. Tasha did a project where she was trying to recreate the scent of somebody's home from the past. When she actually got the person in question's, I think it was great granddaughter or something along those lines, to smell this scent that she's created, this person burst into tears because it was so accurate and it gave them such a hit of recollection. As humans, that's so powerful for us that it can't possibly be something that we don't investigate further.
Okay, good job. Ollie, if you're listening, that's how it's done. Pages of research she has. if you've got a suggestion of a trend that Ollie can try out on a future edition of the show, then head to modernmanwith2ends.co.uk and click on the feedback form. And Alex, we should thank our sponsors. We've flipped things around this episode because you're here.
We always do. We're double-ended.
We should thank the handy.com.
They are the world's most powerful sex simulation device for penises that's truly premium quality, easy to use and to clean, and all in all, from bell to ball, the creme de la creme of male creaming machines.
From bell to ball, I love it. If you want to try this supreme male masturbation device, we have a special code as well you can use to get, what is it, free shipping?
Yes, you get free express shipping when you use the code FOXHOLE.
Yes, that's FOXHOLE at thehandy.com. And thanks again to them.
Who knows? In the future, you might actually be able to smell my foxhole.
That is probably something they're going to work on, isn't it? I mean, I don't know if you've been collaborating behind the scenes on future product development, but yeah, the sex toy market is absolutely something where scents play a role. And I mean, you know, we know that from existing products, but you could imagine, couldn't you, if you're interacting with erotica, for example?
Yeah, if you were using a VR headset and a machine like the Handy, you could not only feel and see and hear the action, but you could even, like, inhale somebody's bumholio.
The ever-fragrant Alex Fox there. We'll see her again later. Still to come, you will meet Guy Babcock. Don't Google his name before you hear the interview. But first, our record of the month. It's the new one from Foles. It's called Wake Me Up, and it's out now. We'll be right back. Now, in a world where everyone is just one web search away, it really matters what happens when people type your name into Google. But how easily can that information be manipulated? That's what we're discussing today. And a warning, the conversation goes to some dark places and includes references to child abuse. My guest today, Guy Babcock, lives in Oxfordshire and works in IT. But back in the 90s, when our story begins, he was in Ontario, Canada, where his parents owned a real estate franchise called Remax. And it was a real family business.
My mother was the broker because she'd been selling real estate for quite a long time. My father had come from banking, and so he was doing more of the legal side. And myself, I joined to sort of on the computerized side, and I also helped, you know, I was running the payroll checks and doing all that sort of stuff. My mother was primarily in charge of recruiting agents because you have a bit of a turnover with agents. People come and go. I mean, over the course of how long we owned the company, we probably had at least, you know, 300 to 400 agents at any one point of time.
In 1991, Guy's family recruited Nadir Attis to work as an estate agent. In a firm of hundreds of employees, she quickly gained recognition for her ability to do deals.
We used to have sort of awards for, you know, how much business she did in a year, and she got to what's called the 100% Club, which is a top award to say that she's, you know, doing lots of business and lots of transactions. But then what happened is one day got a call from a seller who was trying to sell her property and it hadn't sold. And she said, "I don't understand why real estate agents keep showing up at my door trying to show my house." She says, "It's not for sale anymore. Hmm. It didn't sell. I had it listed with Nadir Attis and it didn't sell. The listing has expired and I don't understand why people are showing up at the door." We went and we checked the listing and it showed it was still for sale. So we pulled the actual documents, and what had happened is it had been for sale and that it hadn't sold, expired. And then there was what's called an extension that had been signed to say, you know, "I want to keep it for sale for another period." But when we checked the signatures, we realized the signatures on the original contract and the signatures on the extension didn't match. And then we checked and we found some more that had done the same thing. Now, when we talked to her, Nadir Attis, she indicated that the vendor had told her to do that, but they couldn't be bothered to sign it, so they just asked her to sign it.
Mm.
You know, this person was saying they hadn't agreed to it, they hadn't asked for it.
Mm.
So we terminated her.
Were you party to that decision?
Yes, we sort of had a, my mother, father, and myself met and decided what we were going to do about that. And we decided it was too much of a liability, you know. So we terminated our contract at that point for cause, basically saying, you know, we can't allow this.
And did you deliver that to her?
My father's actually the one who told her, I believe, at the time. Now, the other thing that happened is I know she had been looking to maybe move over to another company, another Remax office at the time. And the manager over there had asked us for a reference, which, of course, we couldn't give. So I think that also probably made her a bit angry at us as well, because, you know, we're not going to give a positive reference when, you know, this is the circumstances of why she had to leave.
But you presumably thought, actually, she will be able to get a job somewhere else because she's good at what she does.
Well, she did that day. She joined a different Remax that was in the city beside Hamilton.
Then, for 6 years, Guy and his family forgot all about Nadir Attis. Until...
My mother died in 1998 of cancer. And in the beginning of 1999, we suddenly got a campaign of letters that were sent out to my mother's parents, my grandparents, and I think maybe my sister and my aunt and all sorts of different people. And they were just horrendous letters. We're talking about the parents of my mother who've lost their child, and they were being sent a letter basically celebrating the fact that she was dead.
Mm.
you know, and saying terrible things about, you know, her body and the grave and all sorts of things like that. It was just horrendous. And then what happened, probably within a week of that, where my father lived, all the neighbors in that neighborhood received letters anonymously saying that my father was a peeping Tom and to watch out for him. He was hiding in the bushes looking through their windows and things like this.
And were they stamped and addressed, or had someone gone around putting it through the...
No, they were all stamped and addressed.
Okay.
Yes.
How long did it take you to work out those were probably from her?
My father thought it was her right off. He was like, it has to be. Like, who else has ever threatened me or anything? So he was 100% positive. And of course, don't forget, this is in 1999. She had left us in 1993. So we're talking 6 years.
And you'd not cross paths at all?
No. Because we couldn't prove exactly who it is, that made it even worse.
Mm.
Because you're thinking, I'm sure that's who it is. But, you know, is there someone else out there that hates us so much that they could do that? Because to me, it was just over the top. Like, someone must really hate you to send the mother of someone who died, you know, a letter like that.
But also, it's not as if you're public figures. It's not as if your mother dying was being reported in the national news.
No.
So it's, you know, it's someone who knows you.
Oh, it had to be.
And who's been watching the family.
It had to be someone that knew us for sure.
So did that make you unsettled? Did you think, where is this
happening? Yes, very unsettled. And that's what was bothering you. You're thinking, I'm probably going to have to live with this for my life. I'm never going to know who hated us so much that they would do something like that.
Decades go by. In 2002, the family business is sold. Guy moves to England to study at Oxford Brookes. He marries. He has a son. Then, in September 2018, he gets a phone call from his father.
It was a weekend, and we'd gone out with friends. I think we'd just gone to the pub for Sunday lunch or something. We come back, and I get this frantic phone call from Canada, and he's clearly quite upset, and he was part of a seniors club.
How old is he now?
He's 89 right now, yeah. He said a lot of the directors of the board got an email saying, I think you better know that one of your members, John Babcock, has sons who are both pedophiles. And he'd gone online to look, and sure enough, he'd, you know, put in our name, and then, you know, all of these different postings saying that we were pedophiles, and photos of us and that were on the internet.
What did he say to you?
He was just really upset. He was basically saying, you know, I can't believe this is terrible. And so, of course, I initially wanted to keep him calm. So I'm sort of, oh, it's okay. You know, it's probably just a scam of some sort. Someone's doing that, and then they're probably going to ask us for money to take it away or something.
You'd
like that.
Had no sniff of this until this point.
No.
You'd never self-Googled and found anything like this?
I never thought to Google myself, to be honest. I don't think people normally do. I don't know. It's just not something I'd really think about, because I don't really have a huge online presence. At that point, I had a Facebook account just to keep in touch with, you know, my school friends, but I didn't really post very much, you know, so I didn't really have much of a presence at all.
So in that first conversation, are you already with him discussing where this might have come from?
No, actually, at that point, we hadn't. He was very just upset about seeing it. So my main thought at that time was just to calm him down and tell him, you know, it's okay, and I'll look at it. Don't worry about it. I'm sure it's just, you know, a scam or something like that. Because, you know, he was getting very upset about it. So, of course, then after I got off the phone with him, I went and looked up. Yeah. It was just, it was horrendous, because the thing that was really bad when I would Google myself is that, of course, Google had changed the way its results look, that it puts images at the top.
Mm.
The person who'd done it had been clever enough to actually take images from my Facebook and my LinkedIn account and had put pedophile on the images. So when you'd come up, you'd see nothing but images of myself across the top with pedophile across them all.
How did that feel when you first saw that image?
I was just, oh, I think I just felt sick to my stomach. It was just so visual. It's overwhelming because it's so visual.
And it's Google. It's the Oracle, isn't it? It's what you ask any question to. What's the weather going to be like in Oxfordshire tomorrow?
Yes.
Well, you know, who is Guy Babcock? And the answer is paedophile.
And everybody's using it. And that's the thing. It's not just, you know, is a friend going to find it? You know, is work going to find it? And also having a young son as well. You know, my other thought was, you know, other parents and stuff like that. If they, you know, happen to Google me for whatever reason and see this sort of thing, like, you know, I don't want him to be impacted in any way by whatever's going on.
Your heart must have been racing.
Oh, I guess despair is the way I would think about it, because in my mind at the same time, particularly since I have an IT background, I'm thinking, how can I possibly fix this? I'm the sort of person who often, you know, if there's an issue, I want to fix it. I'm a fixer. And I looked at this and said, I don't know how I can possibly fix this.
What happened when you clicked the links?
Well, it would take you to the sites, you know, and then they'd have these, you know, stories.
I've read some of these stories. You can still find them online. Here's one. Guy Babcock is a child molester and dangerous paedophile in Oxfordshire, England, United Kingdom. Here's another. Guy Sanderson Babcock lures children on the internet pretending to be a preteen. This piece of shit is a predator. This cretin has a long history of grooming and sexually abusing adolescent boys. There's more. Guy Babcock arranged to meet several boys under 14 for sex at hotels across the country and had been speaking to at least 39 decoys online at the time of his arrest. And just for good measure, Guy Babcock is a racist piece of shit.
Like all sorts of crazy made-up stories. The URLs were like, you know, cheatersexposed.com and badgirls.com. They're sites where people go and post, you know, stuff because they're mad at someone else. You know, well, my boyfriend cheated on me, so I'm going to go to Cheaters Exposed and put your photo and stuff on there. And of course, you know, you're clicking on the things and, you know, it's coming up saying, do not ask us to remove it. If you tell us to remove it, we'll never remove it, blah, blah, blah. But click here and for a fee, we'll help restore your reputation.
Wow.
And sometimes it's $2,000.
Hold on. So these tawdry revenge sites are monetizing the people that are being slandered.
Absolutely.
That's really shocking. Yeah. And the numbers involved are shocking too, because even though that's a really horrible business model, if they were charging $50 to remove a post,
yeah,
that would be within, you know, the affordability of most people being slandered in that way. You're saying for you to actually pay up as they're asking would cost you over $200,000 across all these sites.
Actually, I currently have over 640 posts against me. Well, so I think we're talking a million.
So to come to your question then of how do you fix it, if the business models behind these companies is so screwy and unfair, and they don't have just a polite policy of we will drop this story about you because it's untrue, are there any other methods available to you? Because I imagine these websites must be based in Russia or China or something.
No, actually, most of the sites are based in the US.
Really?
And in fact, most of them actually have an office, or they're listed as Arizona, which what? Has the least restrictive rules of these companies. They almost every one you go on, if you actually click on the link and it talks about removals, the first thing it does is it quotes Section 230 of the, I believe the U.S., it's called the Communication Decency Act, which is a very funny name. But basically, Section 230 makes it that the publisher of comments is not responsible for the comments.
So that's the technology that underpins Facebook, I guess, right? So anyone can say something on a post and it's not the responsibility of the company.
That's right. So they're saying that they want that so that people can, you know, speak their opinions without feeling like they're being censored.
But there's no provision for something being completely untrue. You can't do anything about it.
What I can do about it, they're saying, is that I need to go after the author. But of course, the site allowed the author to be anonymous. So how can I go after the author if I don't know who the author is? After I Googled myself, after my father had called, I went and I started Googling other family members. So that's when I realized it was my father, not only my father, but it was my brother's wife, my sister.
What was it saying about them?
Basically, the women, it was normally that they're thieves or scammers. And for the men, it was always that they're pedophiles. Even my sister's son, who at that time would have only been around 18, was also labeled as well.
Yeah. I mean, it's like the worst thing to be called on the internet anyway, but yes. Particularly at 18.
Yeah, you're just starting out, and you know, and it's a little different for me at an older age. You know, when you're sort of established, it's one thing, but you're young and you're just going to be going out of school and you need to go look for jobs. You know, because I'd say most HR departments, they're probably Google just about everybody that they interview, right?
Right. Yeah.
And now if you've got, you know, 10 candidates or 20 candidates and you come across something like this, you're not going to bother trying to figure out, is it real, is it not real? You're just going to toss it. So what we did is we compiled a document. So we went looking for all the links we could find. We searched all our family members and we documented absolutely everything. I think our document was like 100 pages. And then we decided we'd go to the police.
Can I just say, this all sounds very diligent. And it sounds like you're doing an incredible amount of research to present a case. But on a guttural emotional level, was there a part of you that just wanted to put a Facebook post up right away saying, by the way, contrary to what you've read online, I'm not a paedophile? Were you able to hold that in?
Actually, I think my reaction was the opposite. I, you know, deleted my Facebook account. I deleted all my accounts. You know, if I could unplug the internet, I would have, right? It's just the big concern for me was, you know, what do I do with friends that I know? Do I tell them? Do I not tell them? Mm. Right? Because, you know, it's like the, you know, where there's smoke, there's fire. Like, I don't really want to bring the subject up. Mm. I don't want to get them, you know, if I go to you and said, whatever you do, don't Google my name, what are you probably going to do? Mm. You're going to go and Google my name, right? Mm. So it was a real challenge for me. And I'm thinking at that time that, you know, I just hope that nobody I know has any reason to put my name into Google.
Did you also worry about, if you like, the particles of smoke they might start sniffing for? Because, you know, as soon as you say that word and associate it with you, you do fit the profile of a cliche of what people think. Oh, he's a middle-aged white guy and he lives in a little village and he's very discreet and he doesn't really have a big social profile and he works in tech. I mean, yeah. It's all terrible stereotyping. But it's, you could see that people might start putting things together and think maybe that fits.
I mean, the people in the village thought, you know, they won't, I don't think they'd believe it, but there's always going to be a doubt in anything. Like if you had a child, you're still, even though you may not believe it, you're still going to be careful, right?
Yeah.
Like I would be too. You know, in reverse, if I saw that of someone, I would immediately, you know, be cautious around them. And that was my concern, was that, you know, if I mention it, I don't really want to bring the subject up because there's, even though they may believe me, there's always going to be a little seed of doubt with anybody, right? You know, as why is someone saying this about you? I don't understand that. Because that's not normal behavior, right? Why would someone go and accuse you of being that?
Even if it's a lie, he must have done something awful to merit.
Yeah, exactly.
It's the same as the letter, isn't it?
Exactly. You must have done something awful because nobody would want to do that.
Yeah.
And about 2 weeks after my father had called, I got a phone call from a close friend of mine from the village that we had been living in. And my friend, you know, he started the conversation, you know, we've known each other for a long time and we're good friends. And, you know, and he's like, I got approached by one of the other parents at the school that apparently they've online seen, you know, this stuff. Mm. And I was just, my heart just dropped. It was like, my worst nightmare
has just literally the worst come thing. True. Yeah.
It was the one thing I was worrying about the most, and it actually happened.
Because your son at this point is 9.
Yes. He's 9. Not only that, but we'd recently moved from that village, and it was just before Halloween, and my son had requested that we go back to the village on Halloween to do trick-or-treating with all the other kids. So I'm like, I definitely can't go back, you know what I mean? I'm not going to be walking around in the dark with all the kids and stuff like that if, you know, if that's the gossip in the village. you know, which is, you know, potentially. So it was just, I have to say, it was probably the worst day I ever had. It was like my worst nightmare had come true.
Did you call the school?
What I did is I spoke to my friend and I, you know, explained what was going on. So he went and then spoke to the mother, who claims that she hadn't talked to anybody else yet at that point. So I left it at that point.
I mean, it shows how quickly gossip like that will spread, doesn't it? Because probably one concerned parent does mention it to one other person, but people can't hold that kind of information in.
No, I don't know. I wasn't approached by anybody else, but yes, you're right. That was my concern, is that once one knows, then they're going to mention it to another, and it's going to happen. So that was my biggest concern at that point.
What happened with the police then? Well, which police force did you go to? Because your brothers are in Canada still.
Well, my brother-in-law went to the Montreal police, but he couldn't seem to get past the desk sergeant. They basically didn't seem to understand. They're like, well, you know, people say bad things about other people, you know, just, you know, don't worry about it. I have to say the UK police took it seriously.
Did you get any sense that they were thinking, oh, but this is what a paedophile would say, we need to be careful?
No, I got the feeling they did believe me.
Because you got and turned yourself in and said, this is happening.
This is what's happening. And I showed, you know, all the documents we had. And I showed, you know, it's not just me. It's, you know, my brother, my sister, my brother-in-law, my father, like, obviously, it's all of us. So, you know, you wouldn't expect it would be the whole family. So they took it seriously and they took a report. The police officer actually said he was, you know, quite interested in the case. This would be, you know, interesting to try and find who's behind this. I was very worried, not only about what was being shown online and with my friends, but even for my family's safety. Because around that same time, there was two articles in the BBC about these vigilante groups that had gone after the wrong person.
Mm.
And I thought, you know, if they look at this stuff, you know, they may not be too bright. They may think it's real. I don't want them showing up at my door, particularly if I'm not home and my, you know, my wife and 9-year-old is at home at the time. So I put in, you know, CCTV, you know, I made sure the front gate, you know, for the driveway is always locked. I have a large dog in the back now.
Did you really? You got the dog for that reason?
Yeah. I even asked the officer if it's possible to get a gun permit, and I personally am very anti-gun, but I was just concerned, you know, what if someone shows up at my door? Mm. You know, it was scary.
Still to come, reputational management, the right to forget, and deep in one of the blog posts smearing him, Guy gets a blast from the past. That's after this. Man fans, if on occasion I make reference to a specific piece of foreign culture that you just wished you could watch right now if only it weren't for those darn geo-blocks, then may I heartily recommend NordVPN. NordVPN allows you to access TV shows, news websites, sports and movies from over 59 different countries by changing your virtual location. You can even pay for streaming platforms at a lower price than the one at home. Plus, it's great for using on public Wi-Fi systems like in airports and cafes to keep your data and emails secure, all without slowing down your connection. Just switch it on and away you go. Head to nordvpn.com/man, that's MANN, or use the code MAN, MANN, to get 73% off your 2-year plan, plus 4 bonus months for free. But be quick, because this offer is for a limited time only. That's nordvpn.com/MANN.
Ollie Peart here, a.k.a. The Zeitgeist. I may be away having a baby, but you didn't think you'd be able to go a month without hearing me tell you about the best way to trim your balls, did you? Because that's exactly what I'm going to do now. You see, Christmas is just around the corner, and Manscaped have decided to celebrate early by offering you, yes you, 20% off and free shipping at manscaped.com when you use the code MAN. That's MANN. And if you're looking for the perfect gift for your gonads, the Performance Package 4.0 is the way to go. I have it right here, and it has got everything you need to give your nuts a Christmassy spruce up before the festivities really begin. As well as some silky smooth boxers, you'll get the Crop Preserver and Crop Reviver, an anti-chafing ball deodorant and moisturiser, and a toner, which Smells like Santa's sack itself, all nice and lovely. And of course, the gift that keeps on trimming, the Lawnmower 4.0. This thing can chew through the thickest of wickets, trust me. And with its proprietary skin-safe technology, you're less likely to nick your nuts, which is a good thing. So, what are you waiting for? Head over to manscaped.com and use the code MAN for 20% off and free shipping. That's MANN at manscaped.com. Your balls will thank you.
Let's dive back into Guy's story now. With hundreds of posts on the internet claiming he's a paedophile, and the websites hosting them, mostly based in Arizona, not only refusing to remove the stories, but wanting to charge him for the privilege, he's turned to the police. And one sympathetic officer in the UK has asked him to collate as much evidence as he can.
So what I did is I went back and I Googled myself. Now, I'd already captured like the first two pages of results. But I thought, you know what, I'm gonna try to be as thorough as I can. I'll keep going. So I kept going through the results and basically documenting everything. And about when I got to about page 10 of results, which nobody would normally go to, I came across a link to a blog. Now, the reason why it was so low on the results is because the actual page wasn't about me at all. But what had happened is in the comments for the blog article, they'd put in a post against me.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And when I looked at that post, there was actually a small photo. Now, it was very small. But as I looked at it, I kind of thought, that looks sort of familiar. And I hovered over it, and it then pops up and shows a larger image. And sure enough, it was Nadir Addis, who I knew from long ago. And I remember seeing it, and I just sat there, honestly, for 2 minutes, staring at the photo in complete shock. I was like, I can't believe I've actually figured out who it is.
Mm.
Everything started going through my mind. I started thinking, this makes sense to me. This puts everything in place. Now I know it was her with the letters, because I'd been left with that mystery from 25 years ago. I think it was her, but I don't know it was her. I then Googled her, and I came across a blog article by a lawyer in Toronto who I didn't know, who was talking about the fact she was in this huge court battle with Nadir Addis, and then described how she was being attacked online, not only her, but her daughter and other relatives. And when I read that, it was like, that is us. Like, the article read, it's exactly what we were going through. The fact that it's, you know, my brother and my sister and cousins and nephews, it's all the exact same thing. So I sent an email to my brother-in-law and said, look, you got to talk to me before you go to the police. I know who it is. This is who it is. And here's a link to this blog by the lawyer to show we're not the only ones. I had to go pick up my son, and on my way back, I got a phone call from my brother-in-law going, we have to talk. He says, I called the lawyer, and it turns out they're going to court tomorrow. And we basically have the smoking gun, because right. I actually have an actual posting with her photo on it, right?
Did you want to get involved in that? Because there's two sides to you, I guess, when you're dealing with this. At this point, you're so deep in it. Of course, you'd rather this had never happened at all, and it's awful.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, it's got the narrative of a thriller at this point, hasn't it? Last minute court document, you're going to be part of a thing. Was there an element of you that thought, this is quite exciting? I can actually do something about this.
I think it was exciting that I felt that I'd figured out who it was, and yes, maybe we could somehow put a stop to it, which is what I really wanted to do. But you're right, on the other half of me, you're thinking, okay, if I now get involved and she's now aware that I'm involved, is it going to get worse? So that was a real concern for me. But I think the thought was, you know what, it's never going to stop if we don't do something about it.
What did the police do at this point? There's enough there, isn't there, for them to at least interview her?
On the UK police side, basically, once we'd identified who it was decided that the crime was committed in Canada, because that's where she is. Even though one of the victims is here, the crime is committed in Toronto, where it's being posted from.
Which makes sense. But it's so frustrating.
It is. So they basically said, you know, we'll cooperate as much as we can. The officer actually came to my house and he sat here and said, if she was here, she'd be arrested by now. But she's not. So it's up to them to do it.
So what do you do at this point? Do you just despair, or do you think there's still more we can do?
I think I felt positive at first finding the lawyers because we're not alone in this. So it was nice in that way. And it seemed like they were working on a process to try and get it resolved. But then when I realized that they've been dealing with her for years and she's still posting against them, then it became more despair. Like, you know, is this going to even make a difference?
What happened in the court process?
So what I think happened at one point, the judge had put out a decree basically that she's not allowed to post against them as part of the process. Though interesting, that's about the time that then she decided to start going after us. So I don't know whether it was that at that time she said, okay, well, I won't do that because there is the judge is saying I can't and I could go to jail for contempt. And then instead looked back in her past to other people who she feels has done her wrong. Because it wasn't just us. When I started searching, I realized it's probably not just us. It's got to be other people back in the real estate industry in that city. So I started thinking back, okay, 25, 30 years ago, who were the top agents? And I started putting their names in. And more times than not, I would find them as well. I would just like randomly pick a name of someone I know that was a top agent back in the market 30 years ago. Even if they're deceased now. And when I would Google them, sure enough, exact same stuff with them and their families. So they went to court and then we joined a fourth one to also try to get her to stop. The judgment came out and the judge basically found that there's enough proof that she is the poster.
This is in Canada.
This is in Canada.
So this is actionable.
Yeah. And I remember listening to the judge as he was talking about the case. And at one point he stopped and says, I don't understand why the police haven't got involved at this point. I do not understand. It makes no sense.
So what was the conviction that was secured against her?
So the judgment that came out basically said that she's the poster. It gave those of us in the lawsuit basically ownership of the post so that we have the legal right to go and ask for it to be removed, because even though she's the author, we own them. But this is just in Ontario. The problem is it's all in the United States that these websites are, and they won't recognize the decision from...
The United States won't recognize the verdict of a Canadian court.
No.
Did she get any custodial sentence?
She actually was put in jail for, I believe it was 17 days for contempt of court because she'd upset the judge quite a few times. What we'd found out, and this was mainly from the lawyers, was that she was actually living in a homeless shelter. And basically, she would get up every morning and go down to the public library and sit at a public terminal in the library. And she would be there all day until it closed at night.
Wow.
Every day. That was all she did, is basically lived at the homeless shelter and then spent her day on a public terminal in the library posting.
Was there an element of that story that made you suddenly feel more sympathetic towards her? I mean, that's a very sad life to live, isn't it? And it sounds like one. You don't want to diagnose, but that sounds like a mental illness of some kind.
I don't feel sorry for her, no. I think she's the author of her own, you know, her own world. You know, I feel like when she was with us, we gave her lots of chances. We were very supportive. I remember my parents were always, you know, trying to give her suggestions or trying to, you know, to help her, you know, be a better agent.
Well, help is the thing, isn't it? So it's kind of like, you know, I mean, it's so easy for me to do this because I can be objective because I'm not in the middle of it being called a pedophile.
Yeah.
But obviously there's two routes to stop this happening, isn't it? One is the technological one, which you're pursuing, and the other one is for her to get help and stop doing it herself.
Yes.
And so from that pragmatic point of view, even, it's like they're a part of you that's just thinking, if she got better, this wouldn't be an issue.
Yes. But I mean, up to this point, she still won't acknowledge, even with the judgment, that it is her.
Oh, really?
She's still denying that it's her.
Okay.
That she feels there's a conspiracy against her. We're aware of 150 victims at this point.
Wow.
And she is saying that all 150 victims are in a conspiracy against her. And she basically goes after anybody who's associated with anyone.
So do you think we're at risk by covering this story?
Absolutely.
That's what you'll anticipate is going to happen now as a result of being on this show.
Well, at the moment she's on probation, she's not allowed to go near a computer. So there's a risk, but whether it's going to happen or not, there's been quite a bit of media on it, I think.
So this one might slip by unnoticed.
You might slip by unnoticed because, so we had the judgment on January 28th. On January 31st, 3 days later, the New York Times article came out with me on the front page about this whole story. And then a short time after that, she was arrested by the Toronto police and was then let out on bail, but she's not allowed to post. And several weeks after the article, suddenly we started getting posted. I have, I think, 40 posts against me around the beginning of February. But the editor of the New York Times, her daughter, had like 80 posts against her.
Wow.
And clearly, you know, the being the daughter of the editor shows where it's coming from, because I don't know that person. I wouldn't even know the name to see it. But this is, you know, there's a relationship there. Now, shortly after that, I did do an interview with a paper in Canada, and the reporter who interviewed me, I said to him, I said, you have to realize that if you put out an article on me, the odds are you're going to be attacked as well. Just so, you know, because I felt a bit guilty about, you know, I want you to be sure you realize, you know, yeah, what's entailed when you interview me. And he'd just recently done a article on a mob hit. So he was like, oh, don't worry about it. I mean, I just did an article on a mob hit. I didn't, you know, this is, doesn't bother me. When the article came out, there was no name on it. So here's someone who's a reporter. He's used to doing some, you know, high profile stories. You know, even the last one was on the mafia. And he was too afraid to put his name on the article.
So for you, do you just have to reconcile yourself to the fact that when you Google your name, this stuff will always come up until... I was about to say until she has no access to computers, but even then, it's, if you haven't managed to get the original post taken down, they're still there too, right?
I probably fare a little better than the others because there's been some press on me. So I now have an online presence. So not a good one, but I have an online presence. I see.
So if you Google your name now, you get the front of the New York Times, which exactly. is you saying, I'm not a paedophile.
Exactly.
It's still associating your name with the word paedophile.
Unfortunately, it is. But at least context. There's other contexts, you know, that comes up as well. But the other victims don't have the luxury that I do. And that's the problem. Google has recently come out saying that they will remove links to sites that it's pay to remove. Extortion sites, basically. Mm-hmm. So sites that post stuff but say you can have it removed if you pay, they will delist those if you request it.
So the websites are still allowed to exist under US law, but yes. Google won't link to them.
That's right.
Okay.
Which is still it's a major thing to do that. Now, yes. Whether how successful that is, I don't know, because that's just something that we become aware of. But these sites, yes, they still exist.
It seems so ridiculous, though, that you have to go like on bended knee and say, please remove this. For a start, the image is your copyright if you posted yes. it to LinkedIn in the first place. And secondly, these are the biggest companies in the world you're talking about. Mm-hmm. Google and Facebook yes. and Microsoft.
Yes.
There are people who are paid there to deal with this stuff.
Yes. And it's a challenge for us because I'm just an individual. How can I take on a Google or a Microsoft or whatever? They're almost as large as a country, right? Now, when I first came across the post back in 2018, one thought I did have was, hey, you know what? I'm luckier than the rest of them. You know why? Because I live in Britain and I'm part of the GDPR. So I can go just do right to forget and get my stuff removed. So I went through the process and the first email I got back from Google was explaining that, you know, we don't make judgments on content. We're here just to index what's on the web.
Because that's their standard knee-jerk response.
Exactly. So I went back to them again and said, I'm being harassed. It's criminal harassment. Here's the police report number. Here's the police officer if you want to call him, etc. The second email that came back said, can you please tell us when you got out of jail and what your conditions for release were? And I was just, you know, this is where despair comes in because you're this is the whole point. I'm not a criminal. So yes. I wrote back to them and said, this is why I'm asking you to remove it. I'm not a criminal. I'm a victim. But they're treating me like I'm a criminal, that I'm supposed to give this information. So what I did after that is I, of course, there's a process where you can complain to a privacy commissioner here in the UK, a complaint against Google that they won't remove the stuff. And I heard back after about 3 months from the commissioner asking if it had been resolved. And miraculously that same week, some of the links actually disappeared off of Google.
It was a decision, though, wasn't it, to put your head above the parapet and talk about this?
Yeah, it was. I had to think about it at first because, you know, again, here, my reaction was I wanted to do the exact opposite. I wanted to hide. I removed all my social media presence. I don't really want to talk to anybody. I don't want to tell anybody. I just want to, you know, almost pretend it hasn't happened, because you just feel so hopeless and helpless, you know. And I'm a very private person, so it was a challenge for me. But then I thought it's something that we have to deal with. If there's going to be any change, people need to know about it. I remember talking to my wife shortly after it all began, and I turned to her at one point and said, you know what, if people knew how easy it is to destroy someone online, they would be frightened, right? It never occurred to me that how possible it was, you know, because we're not talking one post, we're talking, you know, last count, we were over 12,000 of her posts. And it can happen to anybody.
Guy Babcock. And if you've got a story you would like to share on a future edition of the podcast, then please do reach out. We are at modernmanwith2ends.co.uk. Just fill in the feedback form. Next up, we talk getting it up with Alex Fox. It can only be the foxhole after this. Right, time to talk.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
About sex, as we welcome back Alex Fox for the second time this episode. Twice a night, Fox, I'm going to call you now.
I'm spit roasting our listeners' ears, entering at both the top and the bottom of the show, like a double-ended dildo of a human.
This episode of The Foxhole, we're going to talk about erectile dysfunction in association with Mac clinical trials. More about them later. But we know from our inbox, Alex, that this is an issue that a lot of men worry about, but including surprisingly young ones.
Yeah, men worrying about their willies literally not being up to the job of entering somebody's inbox or otherwise providing pleasure is one of the things I'm contacted consistently about the most, which isn't really surprising, because according to what research you read, it's estimated that about 4.3 million chaps in Britain are having trouble with their old chaps at some point in their lives. Yeah, I do hear from surprisingly young men. There was a study done recently that showed that over a quarter of British men say that issues with gaining and maintaining an erection, which is what ED or erectile dysfunction officially is, have at some point affected their ability to be intimate with a partner. And 28% of those respondents were aged between 25 and 34.
And it's not just a challenge for men either. I mean, obviously, you know, this affects everyone in a relationship, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of the males that I get are from female partners concerned that the problem is down to them, even though the men in their lives are telling them, no, this isn't because I don't fancy you. If erectile dysfunction keeps happening, it can be really difficult not to convince yourself that the issue does lay with your own either sexual skill or how much your partner is attracted to you.
So what can the causes be? We spoke to someone on the show, didn't we, a couple of years ago who put his impotence down to pornography and said he was watching too much porn.
There's a whole barrel of reasons. Everything from smoking, because nicotine causes blood vessels to constrict, making it tougher for blood to get to where it needs to be to pump everything up. Diabetes can be another cause. If you're carrying more fat than is healthy or optimally healthy for your body type, then that can have an impact. Stuff like high blood pressure, high cholesterol. Ideally, men should be talking to their GP or a medical practitioner if they're experiencing erectile dysfunction, because problems with your flagpole not getting up can actually flag other health issues elsewhere. But in particular with young men, some of the most common causes I hear are nerves and anxiety. This can be about sex, about a particular part of sex, or it can just be more general. Increasingly, I'm hearing from blokes with body image issues where just getting naked or taking their clothes off in the first place is causing them to be so anxious that it's getting in the way of what's happening in their pants when the pants come off. Porn, as you mentioned, can be an issue for some folks. It's contested whether porn addiction is officially a thing, but we do know that some men who are watching porn in problematic ways, so that they're watching more of it than is healthy for their personal lives, or who have been conditioned by porn to expect sex to be a particular way and then feel either disappointed or underwhelmed or threatened when it turns out to be different, that can interfere with their sexual function.
I guess also like how it's consumed, like times of the day. You know, if you're someone who got into the habit of masturbating, you know, at times that weren't the times that you'd then be having sex, I can imagine, you know, the mood just doesn't feel right then.
Yeah, so much of our sexual function is connected to habits, really, isn't it? So if you've gotten yourself acclimatized to getting turned on at 2 in the afternoon, which is perhaps when everyone in your house happens to be out for their lunch break or whatnot, then maybe getting it on in the evening when the sun goes down, your penis is going down with it.
I thought you were going to say for a moment there, which is perhaps the time when everyone in your house has a wank. I was wondering, even in your enlightened world, that doesn't feel like something people have scheduled across a household.
I'm sure I read a piece of research a while ago that showed that peaks in internet usage spiked at particular times when people were watching erotic material.
Yeah, Boxing Day was a popular one. So what are the treatments then? Immediately, I mean, it's a brand, isn't it? But everyone just jumps to Viagra. It's so well established, you know, the blue pill. Especially if the causes are, as you say, potentially psychological, that doesn't seem like the obvious first step.
What you use to treat ED really does depend on the cause. And sometimes you might need to take a variety of approaches. For example, if your problem is associated with anxiety or depression or past trauma or just pure nerves, then a combination of medication that can help give you a leg up, a third leg up, if you will, plus some kind of therapy or counselling or a more psychological approach to help you feel more relaxed in a sexual setting. Those two things concurrently can work very well for a lot of people. But there are quite a lot of different treatments on the market, ranging from more manual stuff like vacuum pumps and rings where you suck the blood into your penis and then keep it there, a little bit like blowing up a balloon. At the extreme end of stuff, for people who have real issues, there are penile implants. So you can actually put a rod or an inflatable device inside, surgically implanted inside the peen. Yeah.
Wow. That's a great party trick, isn't it? If you can just inflate at will. In any situation.
It depends on what party you're at, I suppose. Yeah. You can also get treatments that deliver drugs directly to the penis via injection or urethral suppositories. Unfortunately, they will also induce tears to spring directly from your eyes. Testosterone replacement is also an option for people if low testosterone is causing the problem. But for most blokes, treatment takes two main forms. The first being therapy. People like Mojo are providing online courses to make that kind of thing a lot more affordable and accessible. And pills. And there's about 5 or so main variants that you can get either prescribed by your doctor or over the counter. And they all work in slightly different ways. But most are what is called a phosphodiesterase type 5 inhibitor, or PDE5. The way that these work broadly is, when you get turned on, your body produces a molecule called CGMP, and that stimulates an erection by increasing blood flow to the peen. And whoop, everything goes up. However, then an enzyme known as PDE5 usually then breaks that CGMP down, restricting blood flow again and causing the erection to subside. What those main 5 pills tend to do is block the action of PDE5. So all the chemicals you need for your erection to be sustained stick around longer, and you've got more of a chance of staying hard for a prolonged period of time.
Okay, so you do still need to be feeling aroused. You won't just suddenly get an erection unless you're feeling it.
Well, this is a key thing. Some of them, you pop them anywhere between half an hour to a few hours before you want to have sex. So you have to plan when you actually want to get jiggy. Others you take more regularly, which allow you to be a bit more spontaneous. But for all of those, you do have to be feeling horny for them to work. They won't just magic up an erection when you're feeling tragic in your brain.
But there are problems with these over-the-counter pills, aren't there?
Yeah, if you've got heart conditions or if you're on certain other medications, then you can't take them. They're negatively affected by food. If you have a heavy meal, then you're not going to be able to as easily get hot and heavy later.
It's such a shame because Dalfrazi laced with Viagra is my personal favourite.
For some people, they also have side effects, stuff like headaches, nausea, dizziness, hot flushes. But the real issue is that these pills, according to what study you look at, only really work for or are suitable for about 60% of men. So there's around 40% of people who just either can't take them or they're not performing as you'd hope.
Wow, that's a lot.
Yeah, it's more than you'd expect, isn't it? I was quite surprised by that. I imagine that a lot of the reasons why people would be looking into new treatments is just to kind of make them better rather than give them more broad efficacy for people. But it really does seem like there are a lot of men for whom the existing solutions either aren't options at all or are very suboptimal.
And one of those new things that's being developed is by Mac Clinical Trials, who are working with us on this section today. So what are they looking at?
They're running two trials at the moment, one for men just with erectile dysfunction and one for men with erectile dysfunction who also have mild depression. And they're using a new medication called iPED 2015. And this works in a very different way to the pills we've just discussed. It actually helps the dopamine signaling pathway in the brain that's involved in getting an erection. So rather than working peripherally on muscles and blood vessels around the penis, it's actually working in the brain.
So interesting. It's kind of like what we were talking about in the Zeitgeist, isn't it? Like, how can you smell something when the smell isn't actually there?
Well, speaking of smells, the neurotransmitter system that this is hoping to act upon is involved in all sorts of things, from your cravings for coffee, which obviously smells delicious, your mood, your level of arousal, all sorts. And as a kind of side note, because of that, Mac Clinical Trials actually think that this same compound might have applications in helping neurological pain, although this is not their main focus. I found that really interesting, though, because originally Viagra itself was developed as a drug that was supposed to help with cardiovascular complaints and heart issues, and it was only noticed as a side effect that everybody on the ward where it was being tested had massive donkons. So it was then reappropriated for use with erectile dysfunction.
And so Mac are looking for people to enrol in these clinical trials, aren't they? What is the trial exactly? What would you have to do?
Well, it starts off with a questionnaire, which is designed to help establish each individual person's baseline of what's normal for them with regards to sex and arousal. So they'll ask them questions about things like how often they think about sex, how often they attempt penetrative sex with a partner. I was intrigued as to whether people would fib on a Q&A like this, because as we know, there's so much pressure to pretend that everybody's sex life is glossy, glorious and brilliant. But I chatted to John Connell, who's Mac's chief scientific officer, and he said because they really need people to be honest in order for these trials to be legitimate, they're quite thorough about emphasising the need for accurate reporting here. So after you've done various questionnaires, you will then be given either 5 milligrams, 10 milligrams of this new drug, or a placebo, a dummy pill. You'll then be tested on whether or not that drug is working as hoped within your system by being asked to watch some porn while wearing a device called a RigiScan, which is a tool that measures the success of your tool. I actually gave this a Google, and I encourage people to do this themselves at home so you can actually see what a RigiScan looks like. It's like a little box that has two wires with loops coming out, One goes round the base of your dong and the other one goes at the top. And every 5 seconds they compress. Apparently that's not a sexy, stimulating feeling. It's a bit odd, but it shouldn't. It's subtle enough that it doesn't really interfere with how horny or not you may be feeling. Allegedly, it's comfortable enough that often rigiscans are employed to measure nocturnal tumescence. So basically people wear them overnight. So they're fairly comfy and padded and stuff.
I'm glad you're explaining because I missed this episode of Tomorrow's World.
They're primarily at Mac asking people to wear this rigiscan and watch porn for around 15 minutes and they will be observed from another room that's hidden by Mac scientists.
Okay, and what's in it for you, apart from if you're the kind of person who gets off on having people watch you whilst you watch porn with a device around your penis? Do you get paid?
You do. You get £680 plus reasonable travel expenses as compensation for your time. And John and I did chit-chat about how that figure is reached because as part of the ethics of these trials, they have to make sure that they're not coercive. But one thing that a lot of people don't consider is that if you participate in a clinical trial, you are given a pretty comprehensive health MOT. They do things like ECGs, they run blood tests on you. Lots of people actually discover things about their bodies that they didn't know.
So is it safe, do you think?
This is the biggie, really, isn't it? And I imagine for a lot of people, not least because there have been reports in the press in recent years of clinical trials that have gone terrifyingly wrong. Lessons have been learnt from these awful tragedies. Reports have gone into great detail to make sure that everybody else running clinical trials doesn't replicate those same mistakes. But also, I must emphasise, that is so unusual. And the number of hoops that a drug has to jump through before it reaches this stage of clinical trial where we are actually testing it on people are massive. They're tested in labs. They're often tested on animals. They're tested at a very low level and very low doses at first. They're assessed by multiple committees. Mac have actually gone through 6 escalations of initial trials to make sure that the levels of the drug they're using here are thoroughly and utterly safe. They've been in front of the MHRA or Medicines Healthcare Products Regulatory Agency, and they have to ascertain before they reach this stage what the PK of the drug is, or pharmacokinetic. That basically means that they know everything about how the drug is absorbed, distributed in the body, metabolized and excreted over time. So although this is a trial, they're not really testing the safety. What they are testing is whether it will do what they hope it will do under some of the circumstances under which it's likely to be used.
Now I want to know what porn they showed the animals. So who are they looking for to participate?
Well, because there are naturally a lot of variables in what causes ED. They need a really large sample size. We're talking hundreds of people in order to thoroughly test this drug at this stage. So they're looking for men, people with penises, aged 18 to 59. You can be any sexuality and you have to have erectile dysfunction. Now, if you've used pills or other treatments and even if they've worked, that's fine. But you have to still be suffering from erectile dysfunction if you're not using any type of intervention. As I mentioned earlier, they're looking for people with ED and also people with ED who also have mild depression. That means that your GP might have noted down something like you having a low mood. They can accept people on certain types of antidepressants, but not others, because some might interact with the drug in funny ways. But otherwise, you ought to be pretty healthy. One thing you should know is if you are somebody with a female partner, they will need to be aware that they will need to use some form of contraception like a coil or pill in addition to you both using condoms for several months after you've participated in the trial. That's because at this stage, they haven't yet thoroughly tested how the drug might stick around in semen, and if it does, whether it will have an effect on pregnancies.
Okay, so if you're interested, where can you find out more?
You can find out more at researchforyou.co.uk/ED study. It's really important for me to underline that you can withdraw at any point during this process. Everything is completely confidential. They will tell your GP that you're taking part in a clinical study, just in case it there are any repercussions down the line, but they won't tell anybody else.
So that's researchforyou.co.uk/ED study. And actually, if you do suffer from erectile dysfunction, whether or not you want to participate in this trial, do get in touch with the show as well. I'm sure we will be returning to this subject on The Foxhole again. Alex, we're going to see each other next for our Christmas special. I'm shuddering already.
Just wait till you see what I've got in store for you, Ollie. It may or may not involve a Ritchie scan.
And with that, we have very nearly reached the end of this month's Modern Man, but there is just time to appoint a new Manbassador. It is Kate in Berlin, who says, "Hey Ollie, I'm a big fan of the show. I want to say a big thank you for all the hard work you put into the podcast. It is a gem I recommend to everyone. And if possible, I was also wondering if you could make me Manbassador of Berlin, please. It would be an honour." Well, Kate, it was your £25 donation on PayPal that really swung it, but I did admire your politeness. And I was surprised to see that we hadn't allocated Berlin before. Hamlin and Dusseldorf, yes. But Berlin, no, it's yours, as Leonard Cohen never sang. Congratulations to Kate. Until next time, our theme music is by Django Django. I've been Ollie Mann, the producer, Matt Hill. And we will see you with our 2021 Christmas Spectacular on December the 10th.
Hi, my name is Kay Adams, and to be honest, I'm not so good with the aging process, so I enlisted my old chum, the filter-free Cara McKenzie, to advise.
Could you imagine being a porn star? The room would need to be really hot for me to strip off.
To be honest, she's not much help, but she is rather amusing. And along with some great guests, Joe Brand, Andy Oliver, Anton Dubek, Ruth Langsford, and Craig Revel-Horwood, darling, we are learning how to be 60. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, on Tuesday, we head to the battlefields of medieval Spain to witness the very first ambulance.
On Wednesday, it's the anniversary of the day Coca-Cola's creator hit on his winning formula. He dropped the wine, but kept the cocaine.
On Thursday, the thief who stuffed the crown jewels down his trousers.
And on Friday, when free-spirited Danish parenting put 90s New York in a tears.
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the Retrospectors. 10 minutes every weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.